Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Friday, the 6th of March, these are our main stories. After a day of talks in Moscow, the Russian and Turkish presidents agree a ceasefire in the Syrian province of Idlib. The WHO urges governments worldwide to take the new coronavirus outbreak seriously. Also in this podcast, Elizabeth Warren ends her campaign for the Democratic Party's nomination for the U.S. presidency, and we hear about the impact of streaming services on the environment.
We are the largest data center hub in the world. The information goes up into the cloud, but the cloud is actually anchored right here in Loudoun County. Since 2008, there has not been a day when there has not been data center construction going on.
That's all coming up, but we begin this podcast in Moscow, where after more than 6 hours of talks, the leaders of Russia and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire beginning on Friday in the troubled Syrian province of Idlib, starting at midnight local time. Speaking alongside President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Vladimir Putin expressed optimism that their agreement would bring much-needed peace.
I hope that these agreements will serve as a good basis for ending the fighting in the Idlib de-escalation zone and will end the suffering of the civilian population and the growth of the humanitarian crisis.
The two leaders' meeting comes after a surge in fighting in Idlib. Dozens of Turkish soldiers have been killed in recent weeks as Ankara launched an offensive against President Bashar al-Assad's forces, who are backed by Russia. The Syrian government's attempt to take Idlib, the last bastion of rebels and jihadists, has forced nearly a million civilians to flee their homes. Our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg told us more about the deal.
After these talks, these marathon talks in the Kremlin, the two leaders came out and they said they had agreed a ceasefire in Idlib, also a security corridor and joint Russian-Turkish patrols. At least one big Turkish demand, important Turkish demand, was clearly not met because Turkey had wanted Syrian government forces to pull out of those areas which they'd recently seized in and around Idlib. There was no mention of that. And that is all. Now, will this be a lasting agreement? Will this bring peace to that area? It's too early to say. We've seen many agreements and deals and compromises in the last few years, which have ended up being temporary. They've eventually unraveled. There's no guarantee that this one is going to last either.
How much of the conflict was down to the clash between these two powerful personalities?
Well, you're right. They are powerful personalities. They're strong men with authoritarian tendencies. But in a strange way, they have great respect for one another. And it's the force of their personalities which has managed to keep this Russian-Turkish relationship on the rails over the last few years. There have been many events which have almost derailed it. You know, when Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet back in 2015, the murder of the Russian ambassador in Turkey in 2016. And yet these two leaders have managed to meet and to agree and to do deals, even though they are on opposite sides in the war in Syria, President Putin supporting President Assad, President Erdogan supporting the rebels. And I think part of the reason that Russia and Turkey are still in this sort of relationship, this partnership, although they are on opposite sides, is down to the if you like, the personal chemistry between Putin and Erdogan, but also the fact that Russia and Turkey believe they have more to gain economically and politically from cooperating with another than with fighting with another.
Steve Rosenberg, the World Health Organization says some governments are not taking the new coronavirus seriously enough. The head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said that in some countries, the level of political commitment did not match the level of the impending threat. But there were encouraging signs of a decline in new cases in several countries, including South Korea. He called for a coordinated approach to help reduce the spread of the virus.
This is not a drill. This is not the time to give up. This is not a time for excuses. This is a time for pulling out all the stops. Countries have been planning for scenarios like this for decades. Now is the time to act on those plans.
Italy remains the European country hardest hit. The death toll there has reached 148, up 41 on the day. In the northern town of Codogno, at the center of the outbreak, a volunteer-run radio station has changed its name to Radio Zona Rossa, or Red Zone, and is doing its best to keep people's spirits up until the end of their town's lockdown this Sunday, as Mike Thompson reports.
Nearly 2 weeks into lockdown, only a lone moped, its driver's face masked, can be seen on the streets of Codogno. The town's eerily deserted railway station echoes to announcements that no trains are stopping there. Yet turn on Radio Zona Rossa and it's clear that Codogno is very far from a ghost town. Massimo Scaglione is the station's grandly titled president.
We give people living under lockdown all sorts of useful information. We tell them when the supermarkets, pharmacies and post office are open. Get protective masks or go to the bank.
Cristo pietà.
With local churches shut, the station broadcasts mass to people's homes, though it's especially hard to fill the void felt by the young. Massimo's daughter, Chiara, is 19.
Everything is closed, so I haven't been to like a bar or a cafe or a club. I mean, this morning I saw my best friend for the first time in 2 weeks.
So there's not much chance of getting a new boyfriend then?
No, not at all. Not at all, actually.
Quack, quack, disse l'anatra. E subito tutti schiamazzarono a più non
posso. With schools closed, The Ugly Duckling is one of many children's stories broadcast by the station's team of volunteers to help keep youngsters happy. Daniela Marciotti is one of the readers.
We thought, okay, children cannot go to the public readings, so the public readings will go to the children.
Though Daniela says a very small minority of adults have been a bigger concern than the children. Has anybody tried to get out of the designated area?
Especially at the beginning, there are patrols, but there are still people who tried to elude them. They have been caught. It's a criminal offence.
Have you ever been tempted yourself or any of your family?
No.
But Massimo Scaglione believes that despite all the fear and hardship the virus has brought,
there's a positive aspect, not just for me, but for lots of people. Our families are back together. These days, life is so hectic and we have little time in our homes. So at the moment, we're living together more with our families, which is a good thing.
That report by Mike Thompson. Now, from today, you'll notice a bonus podcast in your Global News podcast stream. It's a 5-minute coronavirus global update. This short but perfectly formed roundup will chart the spread of the virus with reports from affected areas and details on the latest medical advice. Hope you find it useful. The High Court in London has ruled that the billionaire ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, abducted two of his daughters and carried out a campaign of intimidation against his former wife. Sheikh Maktoum said the judgment had only given one side of the story. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, gave me the details.
I've been sitting in court for the last few days, and today the restrictions have been lifted and we're allowed to say what the court has stood up, which is that Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the ruler of Dubai, has been found by the court to have abducted and forcibly returned to Dubai two of his daughters, Sheikha Shamsa and Sheikha Latifa, and to have orchestrated a campaign of intimidation against his former wife, Princess Haya of Jordan. On the other side of the coin, she had an adulterous affair, which was mentioned in court, and the sheikh has responded to the judgment by saying that he couldn't appear in person because he's the head of state and it's a one-sided judgment, and that he would much rather it had all stayed secret because it's not in the best interest of their children. These are Princess Haya and his children who are here in the UK, and he has appealed to the UK press not to impinge on their privacy. But the details that have come out in this are pretty damning. It includes a pistol being placed with the safety catch off on the pillow of the princess's bedroom in Dubai. This is Princess Haya of Jordan. A helicopter landing on her lawn with the pilot saying, I've got orders to take one person, i.e. her, to Alawir, which is a desert prison right out in the middle of nowhere in the UAE. And a poem that the judge said she had every right to assume was referring to her, saying, I care not whether you live nor die. So there's a fair bit of intimidation there. And in May last year, she said that he had told her, you won't even be safe in England.
So what impact is this ruling likely to have?
For Princess Haya of Jordan, it will come as a relief that finally her side of the story, which has been supported by the court, is now out in the open, because she is alleging, and again this is supported by the court, a campaign of disinformation by the ruler of Dubai that was putting stories into the press alleging that she was linked to terrorist organisations and so on, some of which were wholly inaccurate. So it's in her interest that it comes out. So some relief for her. What does it mean in the long term? Well, it's certainly a very bad news story personally for the 70-year-old ruler of Dubai, who would much rather it had stayed secret. He, I'm quite sure, will refute large parts of it. I think that Dubai is such a, having lived there myself for several years, I think it's such a big and important and global place and such a popular holiday destination that although this is bad news for it reputationally, life will go on. I don't think it's going to actually, in the long run, have a big impact. But certainly human rights campaigners are relieved that the true story has now come out. And it's, you know, it's pretty hideous.
Frank Gardner, in recent years, there's been a huge increase in streaming services, the launch of 5G, and the growth in cryptocurrencies. Experts are now questioning what impact all this extra data is having on the environment. Some centers do run on sustainable energy, but many still use electricity generated by burning fossil fuels, which help heat the planet. Our environment correspondent, Claire Marshall, has been investigating.
One, two, three.
When we post a video or a photo or save something to the cloud, it leaves our device and travels through different networks, maybe through cables under the ocean, to a building called a data centre, where it's stored. When we want to look at it, the video is exploded into thousands of pieces, each one travelling a different route. When they get to your device, they put themselves back in the right order.
So the internet, or the cloud, isn't just in the air. It exists in buildings like this one. I'm in London's Docklands, and fruit and veg used to be traded on these streets, and now it's data, huge amounts of it. In this building are thousands of servers, and they're capturing and storing and sending all our data.
There are now hundreds of thousands of these data centres all around the world. The problem is that many are powered by fossil fuels that are heating the climate. Northern Virginia in the United States is known as the internet capital of the world. The big companies are all here. Microsoft and Google and Amazon, which has built 55 data centres.
We are the largest data centre hub in the world.
Brian Tinsman is the communications manager at Loudoun County Economic Development.
The information goes up into the cloud, but the cloud is actually anchored right here in Loudoun County. Since 2008, there has not been a day, not even one, in Loudoun County when there has not been data centre construction going on.
By far the biggest energy supplier in Virginia is Dominion Energy, which generates much of its electricity by burning fossil fuels, belching out carbon dioxide, a potent greenhouse gas.
A couple of data centers right here. Most of the residents do drive past.
Yeah, Alex Rue is a network engineer who's worked in many of the data centers here. He's also an environmental campaigner.
The problem with data centers is, you know, not their prevalence, not exactly their size. It's mostly about the fossil fuels that power them.
Dominion Energy told us they were committed to net zero carbon and methane emissions by 2050. Amazon said they were working towards 80% renewable energy by 2024 and 100% by 2030. Technology is adapting quickly. Data centres are more efficient than ever. But there is a whole new challenge, and that's 5G. I think the internet's got Professor Ian Bitterlin from Leeds University says the rollout of 5G is likely to pull our lives even further into the cloud.
The biggest impact is going to be 5G. It will launch another vast avalanche of data use, which is not good for climate change, no.
Streaming videos in standard definition rather than HD saves four times the emissions. And using Wi-Fi rather than 3 or 4G uses a third of the energy.
Our environment correspondent, Claire Marshall. Scientists say this latest European winter has been by far the warmest on record. Data from the European Union's Copernicus satellite shows the average temperature was almost 1.4 degrees Celsius higher than the previous record. This report from Danny Eberhard.
The signs have been legion. Winter sports events in normally dependably cold countries like Sweden and Russia having to import snow. Difficulties herding reindeer in parts of Scandinavia. And the first ever complete failure of Germany's ice wine harvest. There's not been a winter like it in Europe, in temperature records dating back to 1850. The seasonal temperature has been 3.4 degrees Celsius higher than that registered on average over the three decades to 2010, and this in a field where records are often broken by fractions, not whole numbers.
Danny Eberhard. Still to come in this podcast, there are calls for restrictions on vehicles on Easter Island after a Moai stone statue was flattened by a truck. And we hear from Zimbabwe, where the number of children going to school is falling.
She's doing nothing in the village, but I was ashamed to have a grade 3 student sitting around when it's so obvious to everyone she should be in school. With my son, I can pretend he's not of school-going age yet.
Elizabeth Warren was once one of the front runners to take on Donald Trump in November's election, but the Massachusetts senator, a favorite of the liberal left, failed to convert early campaign excitement into votes on Super Tuesday. Ms. Warren told reporters outside her home in Cambridge that she had no regrets about her campaign, describing it as the honor of a lifetime, but she believed the odds had been against her.
You know, I was told at the beginning of this whole undertaking that there are two lanes, a progressive lane that Bernie Sanders is the incumbent for and a moderate lane that Joe Biden is the incumbent for, and there's no room for anyone else in this. I thought that wasn't right, but evidently I was wrong.
Our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donohue, told us more about Ms. Warren's decision and the effect it would have on the Democrat campaign.
It's an incredibly frank, isn't it, analysis of your own position and your own failure, if you like, what she's saying there. She's saying she misjudged the political space in which she had to operate, thought there was a political space there and there turned out there wasn't. And you don't often get that from politicians in terms of their own self-critique, if you like. And it does tell you, I think, something about the Democratic Party, which is that, you know, we may talk about American politics all being polarised. Well, there's polarisation within parties too. And that's what I think you're starting to see here in the Democrats. There is a hardcore, and I use that in a neutral way, on the left, the progressive left, the youngsters, the ones who are battling on the things like climate change and big tech and all that, those kinds of issues. And then the more pragmatic kind of older generation in that sort of centrist lane. And that is the scenario that's being worked out in the Democratic primary.
And the one thing she wouldn't be drawn in on is who she's going to endorse, because that is the big question. Her endorsement will be highly sought out after by both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
Yes, it will. And she told people to take a deep breath and think about it for a while. And she wouldn't recommend to her supporters what to do. And she wouldn't say what she would do. She may do nothing. She didn't endorse anyone until there was a single nominee last time when Hillary Clinton clinched it. She may choose to do the same thing again. She did say she would talk about gender later on in this campaign, because she was asked the question of whether gender had played a part in what had happened to her. So we'll see how it works. I mean, she will, you know, if the Democrats win, she will play a significant part in a future administration. I'm sure about that. And, you know, there's always the outside possibility, although I think it's unlikely if Joe Biden is the nominee, for example, the outside possibility that she could be a vice presidential candidate too.
Gary O'Donoghue. Marianne Marsh, a Democratic strategist, gave Tim Franks her assessment of what happened to Ms. Warren's campaign.
Everyone's been waiting for Joe Biden to perform. He was the front runner before he got into this race. He was the front runner through most of this race. But his performance on the campaign trail, faltering at many points, led him to dip in the polls. But roaring out of South Carolina showed everybody what they'd been waiting to see, which is Joe Biden, they believe, is the best candidate to go against Donald Trump. So many people who weren't thinking of Joe Biden before South Carolina on Tuesday left the candidate that they were supporting, including many women who were supporting Elizabeth Warren, African-American voters who've decided to be with Joe Biden, and they all cast their votes for him.
Elizabeth Warren was seen by a lot of people as being closer politically to Bernie Sanders than to Joe Biden. Is your best guess, I mean, clearly we don't know for certain, but is your best guess that a lot of Elizabeth Warren supporters would seem more naturally to fit with Joe Biden then?
Under normal circumstances, you might say that because they do agree on many positions, not all. But I think the overriding concern for everyone in the United States, and especially Democratic voters, the only thing they care about is beating Donald Trump. So if they don't think Bernie Sanders can do it, they're going to go vote for Joe Biden in these primaries. And you see that with women as well. Women, after the loss of Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, determined to elect a woman president. They've elected many women to Congress, and the reason the Democrats won the House back. But they know that beating Donald Trump is the most important thing, so they put their personal concerns aside and desires to have a woman president and cast a vote for Joe Biden as well.
The political strategist Marianne Marsh. Scientists in America calling for more research into the risk to health posed by what's known as third-hand smoke, the residue left by tobacco smoke on clothes and other surfaces. The researchers conducted an experiment at a cinema where they detected many of the harmful chemicals found in cigarette smoke, even though it was a no-smoking venue. More details from Helena Wilkinson.
The researchers wanted to understand more about third-hand smoke, which they described as an important but poorly understood health concern. The team used a well-ventilated cinema in Germany, where smoking wasn't allowed, for their experiment. They sampled the exhaust air duct of the cinema for 4 days and found 35 substances that are detected in tobacco smoke. Concentrations of substances were lower for family films compared to films aimed primarily at an adult audience. The study concluded that those going to see the action films were exposed, on average, to the equivalent of between 1 and 10 cigarettes worth of second-hand smoke, which is tobacco smoke passively breathed in by people in the vicinity of a person who is smoking. The team says their findings offer a real-life example of exposure and that other smaller venues like bars and offices could have much higher levels of third-hand smoke.
Helena Wilkinson, thousands of children are struggling to stay in school in Zimbabwe in the wake of an economic crisis compounded by drought, high inflation and high unemployment. Last year, at least 60% of the children in primary schools were reported to have been sent home over failing to pay fees, and dropout rates are rising. It's a blow for a country whose education system was once considered a model for the continent. Our correspondent, Shingai Nyoka, reports from Harare.
Banta, a private college, is crammed into a tiny yard in the struggling southern suburb of Epworth. The school year began in January, but several of its classrooms remain empty. The college owner, Perkins Chimete, set up the school in 2014. He says compared to last year, there's been a sharp drop in enrollments.
They are there in the village failing to pay money to come, and they are not going any other school around.
In the 1990s, Zimbabwe boasted one of the highest literacy rates in Africa, but it has slid down the rankings, the result of a prolonged economic crisis, inflation of over 500% and falling wages. Families are struggling to cope and spending less and less on education. It's a sign of the desperate times, and makeshift schools are everywhere here in Epworth. It's all some parents can afford, a backyard education. These illegal schools are literally set up in homes and in backyards. Assembly is underway at one of them, Stepin Academy. It's being held in the small front yard of a house. Some children are barefoot or not in uniform. Illegal schools are an increasingly attractive option here. They're more flexible about attendance, school fees, payment terms, and dress codes. Fees at this school are 60 local dollars or $3 US a month.
Some of them are able to pay, and some are failing to pay.
Eunice Maronga is the headmistress.
Some bring 20 this week, 15 next week, until they finish the fees per month.
But a $3 education has few benefits, no desks and one textbook for the teacher. But even then, enrollment is down here too. UN figures show that 20,000 children dropped out of primary school in 2018, and the number is rising as life gets tougher. Elizabeth Chibanda's children are some of those affected. Her food vending business collapsed due to the economic crisis. She couldn't afford to send her daughter back to school, and so sent her to her rural home instead. Her youngest son couldn't begin first grade in January.
She's doing nothing in the village, but I was ashamed to have a grade 3 student sitting around when it's so obvious to everyone she should be in school. With my son, I can pretend he's not of school-going age yet.
In the 1990s, Zimbabwe spent 12% of its GDP on education, the highest in the world at the time. But now it spends less than half of that. Declining standards are evident in government schools as well, with overcrowding and shortages of books and demotivated, poorly paid teachers. Liberty Matsive is with the Education Coalition of Zimbabwe, a civil society group.
One of the major reasons why unregistered schools are actually proliferating is due to the fact that in Zimbabwe we have got a very huge shortage of schools. According to the 2015 Education Sector Analysis Report, we had a shortfall of 2,056 schools.
The government has said it's seeking partners to build the schools needed and has warned that it's illegal to turn children away for non-payment of fees. The country still retains some of its good standing, but the legacy and the strides made two decades after independence in 1980 are slowly and visibly being eroded.
Shingai Nyoka in Harare. Easter Island in the southeastern Pacific Ocean is world famous for the Moai, mysterious statues of human figures that dot the landscape. But a recent incident that saw a vehicle run over one of the sculptures has stoked fears that the monuments are at risk. Peter Goffin reports.
The Moai statues have survived for hundreds of years, through Easter Island's colonization and annexation, through the wind and rains of the South Pacific. But it took just a moment for a pickup truck to knock one of the giant stone figures from its pedestal. Officials have said the collision appears to have happened when the truck's brakes failed. The driver, a Chilean man who lives on the island, has been charged with damaging a national monument. According to the beliefs of Easter Island's Aboriginal Polynesian people, the Rapa Nui, the Moai statues hold the living spirits of revered ancestors. And for many, this incident is just the latest sign that the Rapa Nui's history and culture are under threat from the growing presence of outsiders and lax traffic laws. Easter Island, a Chilean territory more than 3,000 kilometers from the mainland, has all the hallmarks and attraction of a remote South Seas paradise. Its mayor, Pedro Edmonds, has said the population has grown by 50% in less than a decade. More than 12,000 people now live on this tiny island, and another 12,000 tourists visit each month. For years, Mr. Edmonds has called for a ban on cars near important cultural and archaeological sites. But the governing council didn't listen, he told a Chilean newspaper after the crash, and this is the result.
Peter Goffin. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even 5 times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.